As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. This is the very first Game Podcast of the new year. Now, with me in the studio today, and fitting on another triumphant day for Arsenal, it's one Stuart Robson.
Good morning to you again.
Good morning. And down the line, and he's not in his conservatory, he's in his dining room, I'm told, it's Ollie Kay. Later on, we're going to be talking about the beef between Jose Mourinho and Antonio Conte, because we're the media, we obsess over that. Also, we'll be talking about the latest victim in the managerial sack race, which would be Mark Hughes. We're also going to be chatting about what I think is the extraordinary transfer of Philippe Coutinho to Barcelona, and even more extraordinary transfer of Virgil van Dijk to Liverpool, although, let's face it, we both kind of knew that they were coming. And what better place to start than Friday night, third round, traditional Friday night FA Cup fixture, the Merseyside Derby. Ollie, the last time these two teams met in the league, Jurgen Klopp got a little bit upset afterwards. I think very upset. I'd almost say rightly so. But Liverpool dominated Everton and ultimately were held 1-1. This time, without Mohamed Salah, without Philippe Coutinho, who of course is injured, it was a much closer fought affair, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was. Everton showed a lot more enterprise and ambition and quality, really, on Friday than they did a month ago. But this time the questionable penalty appeal went against them rather than for them. And I didn't think they were the better team on the night. I thought Liverpool were marginally better, but it was the gulf in quality that was visible during that 1-1 draw was not apparent during Liverpool's 2-1 win, if that makes sense.
When you say questionable, is it because you're questioning it or because others have questioned it? Because I thought it was
no,
a nailed-on penalty.
Well, I thought it was a. I'm not even going to say soft. I didn't think it was a foul. People say, "Oh, there was contact. Oh, there was a pull." But the reason the penalty was given was because Lallana threw himself to the ground in the same way that the penalty was given for Chelsea at the Emirates a few nights earlier was because Hazard threw himself to the ground, and the reason that Everton got that penalty a month ago at Anfield is because Calvert-Lewin threw himself to the ground. We are constantly seeing these theatrical reactions getting penalties, and you know, it was interesting that Sam Allardyce having come out with that line about you can't put your hands on an opponent in the penalty area a month ago was suddenly sort of saying no, how could that be a penalty? And at least Jurgen Klopp was honest enough to suggest that, it wasn't a penalty then, and this one shouldn't have been a penalty either. I think you've probably got to be consistent about it.
I don't want to make too much out of Bobby Madley's officiating, but I want to talk a little bit about the Mason Holgate Roberto Firmino incident. We're not lip readers, and lip reader doesn't really lend itself to audio anyway. There's an investigation into what may have been said between Firmino and Holgate. Certainly, is it fair to say that it's alleged that Firmino may have racially abused him, or can we not even go that far?
No, I think we can go that
okay.
far. We can't lip read what Firmino said, or what he said in the split second where John Joe Kenny head was in front of him during that TV footage. But we can lip read quite clearly what Mason Holgate said, and that is the allegation that he's made subsequently, and that is what the allegation the FA are investigating. And Liverpool's reaction on the night was, I think, the correct one, which rather than rushing to judge one way or the other, just saying that they will cooperate fully with the with any inquiries, and rather than rushing to judgment as they and indeed other clubs have done in the past.
I think the good news here, though, if there is good news, is that there were so many players around him. You know, leaving aside the TV pictures. I mean, I'm thinking back to Suarez and Evra, but this is different because there were so many people around that you would assume that people would have heard what was said, so that, you know, you're not just, it's not just a question of employing dubious lip readers to read lips. It's a question of, you know, there's enough people that you can speak to, enough witnesses on both teams who were near the action who will have an idea, right?
Yes, I think you're probably right. But the person who was closest to it was the referee. He was standing in between the two players.
Yeah.
And he obviously didn't hear it. He had consulted with his official on the side.
But the referee was Bobby Madley.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the same. This is what gets me. I'm going to leave this one second. We're obviously speculating here about, and there's no point in what may have been said. But I was just struck by one thing, right? What started this whole thing off? Mason Holgate shoves Roberto Firmino when he's basically...
He was off the pitch.
He's off the pitch, right? So one player shoves another player off the pitch. He shoves him with such force that he sends him flying into the stands. And did Madley just get flustered and forget to show a card to Holgate regardless?
I think that was the case, because what Holgate did was inexcusable. There was the ball, as you said, was off the field. He was frustrated because, first of all, the back pass, he'd taken his touch, and then Firmino had done well to get his body in the way. So it was frustration. He pushed him off the field and pushed him into the stand. And I thought Bobby Madley actually did Firmino a favour, because as Firmino was running back onto the field, he was going to do something to Holgate, and Bobby Madley got in the way. The only person that got cautioned was one of the physios for... I think it was for Everton, who actually got sent off, which is a strange thing when two players have almost had a fight. Holgate should have certainly been given a yellow card for his challenge. So in the end, he didn't handle it particularly well.
Two huge stories. I mean, Liverpool really in the past 10 days, the real protagonist, I think, in the transfer window. I want to start with Virgil van Dijk. Ollie, this one's obviously been coming for a long time, but we had Matthew Upson writing for us in the game at the time of the transfer, and I thought he was quite skeptical. And the more I read him, the more I found myself agreeing with him about, A, the fact that, you know, you're buying somebody for 50% more than the most expensive defender in history. You're also buying somebody who's coming off a very serious injury. But most of all, just from a technical aspect, he sort of questioned a little bit the fact that Van Dijk isn't exactly lightning quick. And the way Liverpool play, the center halves are going to be a lot of the time well up the pitch. I don't know. I certainly got the sense that he wasn't in love with the move at all. Is he right?
He is certainly a massive improvement on what Liverpool have already got. Joel Matip top class? Is Lovren top class? Is either of them lightning quick? You know, Liverpool's approach is all about controlling the game, dominating the game, being good enough when they've got possession to survive those moments when the opposition get the ball and invariably create chances. So Van Dijk will make them better, undoubtedly. I think you could see more quality in him immediately than you normally see from Lovren and from Matip and from Clavin. Klopp said something earlier in the season about how you couldn't just improve this defence with a single player. Well, I think he could improve it, and I think he will improve it, but there will be teething problems. I'm sure he'll make mistakes because he's a player who takes risks in possession. And Liverpool still have, you know, questionable and inexperienced fullbacks, and they still have, you know, you would still have a question about the quality of the player alongside him. You'd have a question about the goalkeeper. You would have a question about the defensive nous of the midfielders in front of him. So it's not suddenly going to turn Liverpool into a stingy, mean, solid, resilient defence. It's going to improve the defence they've got. And I've no doubt of both parts of that equation. Immediate improvement, but not dramatic improvement.
Ollie, if you were Liverpool, would you have spent £75 million on Virgil van Dijk?
I'll tell you what, I would have gone for him for sort of 50 million in the summer when that seemed like the going rate for a top class Premier League central defender. But now the market is so ludicrous, 75 million plus they've got the Coutinho money. I don't know. I don't ever like saying that these deals make sense when it's £75 million for a player or £90 million for a player or whatever. But it has become the going rate, as ludicrous as it sounds. And what would be far better would be if they could find somebody who was get Van Dijk before he goes to Southampton, you know, even before he goes to Celtic, you know, be smarter in the transfer market and get players before they're at their absolute peak value.
You say it's the going rate, but it's obviously not the going rate if he cost 50% more than any other centre back in the history of the game. And it's obviously not the going rate when he's in the top 10. I think every other player in the top 10, I mean, not only are none of them central defenders, I think every single one, except for Higuain, who's obviously a centre forward, was either younger than Van Dijk or cost less than Van Dijk. Mm. I mean, Stuart, you watched Van Dijk for a long time. What I find really interesting about him is this is a player who, normally players who go for that amount of money are household names from the time they're 18 or 19. This is a guy who I think was released when he was 17 or 18. He only won his first cap when I think he was like 24 or something. I think he was already at Celtic if I'm not mistaken, when he won his first cap or it was just before. This is somebody who, for whatever reason, the football community did not rate really at all.
Certainly the Dutch football community didn't rate him because they used a whole load of other centre-halves before they went for Van Dijk. Right. And even when they've been struggling, Van Dijk hasn't always been the number one pick.
So is this something where he either improved markedly all of a sudden, which I think is generally pretty unusual, or is it something where collectively the entire football intelligentsia got it wrong?
No, I'm not a great fan of Virgil van Dijk in terms of being a great player or even a top-class player. What he has got, an aura about him because he's big and he's strong and he's very good in the air. He's got decent pace, and when he starts coming out with the ball, he looks quite commanding. The best defenders, and I'll go back to Carvalho, I'll go back to Cannavaro, players like that, Chiellini even, who read the game. They're always, their head's on the half turn, they're always looking at the next bit of danger, they are concentrating the whole time. Virgil van Dijk doesn't do that. That's why he's liable to make mistakes, particularly in a team that try and hold a high line, and when they give the ball away, I don't think he's set ready to start defending the space in behind him. He's very much a physical player, and there's too many physical players playing football at the moment that don't read the game. They use their athleticism to get them out of trouble, and that's what Virgil van Dijk does. He uses his athleticism to impose himself on the opposition and get himself out of trouble without reading the game to start with.
So I'm assuming if you were director of football of Liverpool...
No.
Okay.
he'll improve Liverpool, but not for £75 million, no.
Yeah, I'm sort of with Robbo on this, because I haven't got it. Now, Ollie, the other big move, obviously, Philippe Coutinho. In fact, he's being presented at the Camp Nou, I think, as we speak. My opinion on this has changed in the sense that I thought, well, wait a minute. If you're Liverpool, why sell him now? Because it really doesn't make any sense. Because, you know, you'll get a premium for him, but you might get a premium for him in the summer if he goes and wins the World Cup with Brazil, which is not that far-fetched. But mostly there's the downside risk of not qualifying for the Champions League this year. I mean, Liverpool are fourth in the table. Lest we forget, they're, I think, what, 3 points clear of Spurs in fifth. It didn't make any sense to me why you would go and do that. My opinion's changed a little bit when I considered how much Coutinho wanted to leave. There's an incredible story, I thought, that he paid £11.5 million out of his own pocket to make this deal happen. When's the last time you've heard of a footballer doing that, Ollie?
Never, off the top of my head, but I'm sure that these things are, you know, I'm sure he's not going to end up short. I'm sure it will be made up to him in other ways by Barcelona or whatever. It's unclear. I haven't shifted from your original viewpoint, which was that it's a deal that would have been better off being delayed till the summer. I mean, look at Liverpool are in a similar situation and have been in a similar situation with Keita, who they agreed a deal with last summer for, you know, to sign him from RB Leipzig, and Leipzig just said, right, deal done, you can have him at the end of the season. Now Liverpool are now trying to bring it forward at a massive premium again, but, you know, why should Leipzig do that? Why should Liverpool roll over to let the deal happen now? Coutinho's desperation to make it happen is obvious, and it's understandable because Barcelona are a fantastic club and it's natural that he would want to play there. But I do, you know, if Liverpool said, right, we'll do the deal now, you can go in the summer. Would he really have? I mean, he might have acted up.
It really is an odd one.
August,
Liverpool tried to do that, didn't they? I mean, Paul Joyce, I think, and others reporting that Liverpool wanted to basically sell him now and then have Barcelona loan him back for the rest of the season. If you're Coutinho, you know, you would have had a chance. Yeah, you'll win a Liga title as a passenger, but you would have had a chance to compete in the Champions League this season. And by doing it that way, by actually being sold to Barcelona and being loaned back, you'd be a Barcelona player. So even if you get injured, it's not like, ha-ha, you have to go stay in Merseyside. You know, it seems strange to me that the player wanted to go so badly that for all these reasons you put out. And on top of that, the £11 million, Coutinho's on good money, but he hasn't been around that long. And he hasn't been earning enormous money for that long. This is a big part of his net worth that he's leaving behind in Liverpool. Stuart, would you have ever... You're going to tell me you did that when you moved to Coventry, like, I paid 800 quid out of my own pocket, which is equivalent to £11 million today? No?
No, I didn't quite do that. I sort of not went on strike. To get a loan move to Coventry, I was on a week-to-week contract at West Ham because I'd been injured for quite some while. And I looked at the rules and it said, and West Ham wouldn't let me go on loan. So I looked at the rules and you could, if you're on a week to week contract, you could give them 7 days notice. So I gave West Ham 7 days notice that I was going to leave.
That's because in that era, you're one of the minority footballers who could actually read.
And then they came to me, you said, you can't do that. And I said, well, I can. Here's the laws. And they said, OK, you can go out on loan. And I went out to Coventry on loan, but was still a West Ham player. And then when I came back, I got a free transfer and was able to negotiate my own fee to go to Coventry, which is all very nice.
This is an enormous amount of money. It's the third biggest transfer of all time. I'm counting Kylian Mbappe in there because, you know, that deal, it's a formality. Couldn't really say no to that. I mean,
Liverpool had to take the money eventually, you know, and they're probably impatient because they want to go and get another player to replace him. The player's impatient because he doesn't want to be at a club he doesn't want to be at anymore because Barcelona have come calling. I can see exactly why it's being done at this time. And from a coaching point of view, when you're a coach and you know one of your players wants to go and you're trying to keep him occupied and trying to make him happy and try and get him out on the field to perform, in the end you spend all your time with a player that you know wants to leave and is going to go at the end of it. So you might as well sell him now, get the money and try and replace him as quickly as you can.
Now, this season, as you know, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup as well. And this is in addition to, I'll be honest, the part which excites me most, which is the content, some of the writing that we provide with the likes of George Culkin, Ollie Kay. Oh, he's blushing now, isn't he? Because I mentioned his name. No, I think we have, I'm old school. I'm new. I like my newspapers, even when they're online. Sure. What was your favorite goal of the weekend in the FA Cup? And I suspect, given your love of Arsene Wenger's defensive structure, especially on set pieces, you're going to mention Eric Lehigh's first one?
No. Okay. That was a disaster from Arsenal's point of view. But I'm going to go with Lehigh's second one because it was the great piece of technique because he's having to run backwards to start with. He gets his body in line with it. It's a good first touch. He's got a lot of pressure coming on him and he has to hit straight through the ball. He can't come across it. It was the only technique he could use to get a shot in and he did it brilliantly. And it meant so much for the crowd. It meant so much for Nottingham Forest and it meant so much for the game as well because once Nottingham Forest took the lead, it became a great game.
Now, Ollie, I know that in your youth you were a big wrestling fan. I just wanted to share with you what somebody told me on Twitter, which is that Eric Lehigh is from the same place as Randy Macho Man Savage. What's your goal of the weekend?
I was torn between two, which was Sergio Aguero's second goal against Burnley, but I'm going to go for Jesse Lingard's goal on Friday night. Another addition to his remarkable recent collection of goals. It was just a beautiful, delicious finish, and helped by that camera angle. You know, the way you saw it sort of swerve away, and is it fade or draw? I'm not a golfer, but the way it sort of drifted away from the goalkeeper, it was beautifully struck. And another great goal from Lingard.
I like Pogba's dance afterwards. By the way, Jesse Lingard proving me wrong this season. I thought he was extremely ordinary.
Don't most people prove you wrong over a length of time?
Well, if you wait long enough, it's like buses, right? This is why we have Stuart Robson here. Don't worry, we'll make this mercifully short because we've got a lot of other stuff to talk about. We're not going to dwell on Arsene Wenger too much, but Stuart, this was a car crash. This is the first time that he's been knocked out in the third round of the FA Cup since he's been in England. And obviously he's been in England for a long, long time, since the early days of the Tony Blair administration, I believe.
I think it was Bruce Rioch that last lost in the third round of the FA Cup to Sheffield United. So, yes, it's a long time. What was made worse for him was that he put out a second-string side, a side that have been playing in the Europa League, mostly. But the combination of Mertesacker and Holding at the back had no pace, no reading of the situation. And Nottingham Forest, give them credit, the manager, Gary Brazil, totally outthought Arsene Wenger and Steve Bolt, whoever was in charge of the tactics for the game. He outthought them, let Arsenal have the ball at the back. When they play into midfield, we get really tight, try and win the ball back, and then counter-attack through Brereton, who was magnificent, whether he went into wide areas or whether he played in between the two centre-halves. I think it was, yes, you're right, car crash for Arsenal and Arsene Wenger, but brilliant from Nottingham Forest point of view.
I'm going to be mean to Ollie now. Ollie, you're one of those proponents who blames big clubs for stockpiling talent, not giving kids a chance, and, oh, if you just play them, they'll be good. How's your Willock, your Nelson, and your Maitland-Niles, who, by the way, it feels like he made his debut like 10 years ago, and he still is Maitland-Niles.
No, I thought Maitland-Niles played all right. I think he's played all right for the last couple of months, and Willock and Iwobi and others, you know, I didn't think the young players were the problem. I would look at the senior players, Mertesacker and Walcott, and you know, that's where. Elneny, yeah, you see, I couldn't even remember who they had in midfield. That probably sums it up. I didn't have any real problem with the initial selection. If you take the view that, well, if things go wrong, you need quality and experience and your best players on the bench, and that's what Arsenal didn't have. And it's yeah.
To put context to this, Ollie, and I'll get back to you. I will read to you the Arsenal bench. Now, Stuart, who's an Arsenal nerd, probably knows who all these guys are. I'm only familiar with a couple of them. You had Macy, Callum Chambers, of course, for England international, so we all know him. Rain Adelaide, Da Silva, Ose Tutu, Nketiah. I can understand, to Ollie's point, your point was that if you're going to pay the kids, fine, but then have some big guns on the bench to help sort it out, right, if things go wrong. Mm.
Or the other way around. You know,
or the other way around, yeah.
Play senior players and then have the kids. Well, just have a mix of players on the bench. I mean, I can't work out how that can ever have been the ideal bench for any contingency plan or any scenario in which Arsenal might have found themselves yesterday. You could have had a situation that they did have, which was where they needed quality and experience off the bench, and that, or you could have had a situation where the ideal thing happens and they've got an opportunity to blood more young players because they're cruising, which clearly is what Wenger and Bold and whoever else concluded would probably be the case. And I thought the bench was inexplicable, illogical, and I could understand the lineup, but not the bench.
I feel like we've gone over this for so long, but we need to mention it because this sort of photograph, which we run it on page 3 of the game, I tweeted it out last night, of Lehigh's first goal. I'm going to try to describe it, but basically the it's a free kick all the way from the right. It's an obvious cross, so you put a two-man wall, which is entirely normal. You have a line of attackers and defenders sort of at the edge of the six-yard box, and then you have Eric Lehigh, who went to university. Maybe that's why he worked it out. He's like, hey, look, I can't actually be offside because these two guys that Wenger put on the wall, or that Ospina put in the wall, are standing like basically a foot from the goal line. So I'm going to go and stand by myself in front of Ospina. I mean, it's just beyond shocking. And you have a World Cup winning center back
sticking his arm up for offside.
Well,
he's trying to hold a line and then sticking his arm up for offside.
How does this happen? I mean, this is what I don't understand. I mean, obviously It's an embarrassing screw up. But there's also 11 players on the pitch. And other than the two guys on the wall, I don't understand. Ospina, the center back, whoever's at the far post, they can look across the line. They can see, hey, this isn't working. These are professionals who do this for a living. It's not like this is the first free kick they've ever seen. How does this happen?
Where the free kick was given, you have to defend that like a corner. So, because it's coming from the same sort of area. So you have, and as you said, it can't be offside because the wall is almost a foot from the byline. So then you have to pick up and defend as you would a corner. You could even have people on the post.
Is this a case of just players not? I mean, if I'm Wenger, we can blame Wenger for this. The poor guy was in the stands. Presumably, this is not what he teaches them to do. In training.
I don't think they do enough work on the set play. So they just went out there and somebody said, oh, let's hold a line. Ospina may have even said, get out my way. I don't want anybody coming into my area.
Yeah, so, but once he sees an attacking player come there.
I know. You can't explain it. You cannot explain how bad that was. Either from the coaching department or from the players on the field or from the goalkeeper. And even when the ball did come in, the goalkeeper didn't really attack the ball. He allowed Lehigh to get across the front of him. It's wrong in every department.
Ollie, is this the single ugliest thing you've seen in 2018?
might be getting there. I wish I had a wittier answer, but no, it was just a horrible goal. And you know, when you talk about, oh, is this something that Wenger neglects or whatever, or is this the way they do it at Arsenal? I think it's just symptomatic of a malaise, a lack of sharp thinking, a lack of leadership, a lack of organisation. And those are the things that have been levelled at Arsenal over several years. And it's you know, the club captain was there. You know, their World Cup winning club captain, Mertesacker, who, you know, he's played a lot more football this season than last, but you know, has he ever been that leader, that organiser, that sort of general at the heart of the defence that Arsenal have needed? Do Arsenal have enough of that? Could you imagine any of the other top six teams, maybe Liverpool, conceding a goal like that? But you could not imagine this Manchester United team, this Chelsea team, this Manchester City team, this Tottenham team conceding a goal like that. It was just ridiculous.
Regular listeners know this. I don't follow lower league football at all in England, so I have no opinion on this. I have nothing interesting to say about Forest, but what I do know is obviously they changed their manager recently, and
Warburton went a couple of weeks ago.
Warbs, former Rangers and Brentford manager. I know a little bit.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you. And obviously their owner is the, I think, rather controversial, is an appropriate word, Evangelos Marinakis, who also owns Olympiacos. Go ahead and Google him when you get some time. Do you want to tell me something? How are they fixed? Good? Bad? What can they hope for?
Well, they had a lot of young players playing yesterday. Apparently their academy's good. Gary Brazil, who was the manager, or the caretaker manager, runs the academy. But got to remember, they're 14th, I think, in the championship. They've had a very poor season.
Transition year. Or were they hoping to get promoted?
I think they were hoping to get promoted. Oh. The only thing that surprised me is that their crowds have gone up. So the fan base is better because they've seen quite a lot of their kids have got talent, and people always like when they have homegrown players in the team. But why haven't these players been doing a lot better? And it's easy to play a one-off cup game and play above yourselves. I've seen it many, many times. I mean, I played for Arsenal against York when we lost to York, and they had an 18-year-old centre-forward had a magnificent game. I think he played another 20 games for York at the lowest level and never played again. So you can have great performances from young men. They can pick themselves up for one game, a cup game against the top side in front of a live TV audience, in front of a big crowd, but then never really fulfil that potential.
Ollie, obviously, I know people who know us from all over the world. If you're of a certain age, you know that Nottingham Forest won two European Cups and stopped the unstoppable Liverpool side in the late 70s and all this stuff. How do you see them as a club? I mean, is there dimension to be a Premier League club or to be a yo-yo club? And how do you see the situation?
It's interesting. I mean, I grew up and Forest were, you know, a fixture in the top flight at that time. They just, you know, just won the European Cup twice and were regarded as a big club. But, you know, there are several other clubs that you'd say the same of in the Championship. Football's actually changed so much. And being off that gravy train for the last 14 years in Leeds' case and 19 years in Forest's case, you've missed out on a lot of potential growth over that period. And the suggestion is that they'll go for Paul Heckingbottom from Barnsley, who's renowned as a very good up-and-coming young coach. I hope Forest get it right. I mean, I was a reporter on the Notts Evening Post when Forest were last in the Premier League, 98-99, and that was one of the worst Premier League teams I've seen. They were horrific. But if you'd said to me then that Forest wouldn't be back within 20 years, I'd have been rather surprised.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love the game? Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk. So in our debate this week, we go from one of Ollie Kay's former stomping grounds, Nottingham, to another of his former stomping grounds, Stoke, because I'm right that you covered Stoke as well, right?
I didn't cover Stoke, but...
But you lived in Stoke.
No.
You've got nothing to do with Stoke.
No, I worked briefly at the Evening Sentinel in Stoke. So although your knowledge of the basics of my career is terrifying, you're missing some of the finer details.
Well, okay, thank you. But you're very familiar with Sparky Mark Hughes, who's been let go. I kind of feel like this is one of those things that people perhaps saw coming, and it was sort of presented as like the Coates family are so patient. Is it a case that however patient you are, when a guy's been there a long time, once you get within touching distance of relegation, people start freaking out and worrying and say, all right, this is not going to work?
I think everybody who has watched Stoke closely over the last 18 months or so would say this isn't just somebody who's had a bad 4 or 5 weeks. The malaise, the struggle dates back to the second half of last season, and having started so well at Stoke, Hughes had been struggling really for 18 months. Stoke are, I would say, the most sensible, stable Premier League club, and I know that might not be saying much these days, but they are very sensible, and their sensible decision, as they saw it in the summer, was let's not get carried away by the second half of the season. Let's give him another season. He's doing fine. And they remained level-headed and kept thinking, well, we trust Mark Hughes to sort it. We trust Mark Hughes to sort that. That's been the case even the last couple of months as fan discontent has grown. But it's I think it became completely unavoidable over the last month or so. It was clear that it had unravelled completely, really, for Hughes there, and he didn't have the answers. Tactically, he couldn't lift the dressing room because it seemed to be going one way, and he hadn't bought well the last two or three transfer windows, and it's just come to a natural end because the Coates family, whatever their belief in stability, I think we're starting to panic, and probably right to be panicking because they're in serious danger of going down now.
But is it odd that the catalyst for this would be losing to Sisu in the FA Cup third round?
well, I think it was the final straw. And I think they were close. They've been close to that decision for a while, and they've been looking for a result that would suggest that there's you know, the capacity to turn it around, that they can be reinvigorated. But I think the nature of that performance, as well as the result, and the atmosphere around it, I think it all was just the final confirmation that it was broken, and Hughes couldn't fix it.
If you look at Stoke over the last 18 months, you're not quite sure exactly what Mark Hughes' style of football was anymore. When he first went in there, he tried to change it from a Tony Pulis long ball, very defensive-minded game, to have more creative players, be more inventive with their style of play, although I don't think it was quite as inventive as people were trying to make out.
Yeah, but at least he had skillful players. He had skillful players,
and he was playing them regularly, so those skillful players felt more at home under Mark Hughes than they did under Tony Pulis. But over the last 18 months, they looked disorganised. They looked as though they've lacked spirit at times. They've looked as though they've lacked any cohesion. And the game that really summed it up for me was the game against Chelsea, when he changed half the side. They almost gave the game up after about 20 minutes when they were 2-3 down. The players didn't have any appetite for the game. He's bought poorly. Berahino, you know, that was a bad sign. Mbula, who they bought for a lot of money. Vimmer, who failed at Tottenham, was never going to be a success. Zouma hasn't really played that well for Stoke since he's been there.
Bruno Martinsindi.
Martinsindi, who was a massive reason why the Dutch didn't qualify for the not the World Cup, the European Championships. I think it was inevitable he was going to get the sack. His best days, I thought, were when he was managing the Welsh side and when he was managing Blackburn. I don't think he did a fantastic job at Stoke in those first couple of years. He changed the style, but he kept them where they were, really. And he's gradually got worse and worse, and it was the right time for him to go.
Ollie, the names linked are Gary Rowett, and I also saw Martin O'Neill. I would imagine that's not going to happen. But I think it was your tweet today. You made the point that if you're Rowett, you're second right now in the championship at Derby County. Maybe you'd be better off staying and getting to the Premier League that way. Although then you did point out that Stoke are likely to have a lot more patience than Derby will. You presumably you stand by that since you tweeted it about an hour ago.
Yeah, I haven't, the many responses haven't prompted me to change my view. No, if Stoke make an approach for him, and I'm sure Derby would fight very hard to keep him, it would be a real dilemma for Rowett, because you've got the possibility of leading Derby to promotion. You've got the possibility that Derby could end up missing out on promotion, which is perfectly feasible in that sort of crazy division. You've got the possibility of Stoke either returning to being a stable, reasonably progressive mid-table Premier League team, or they could go down and be in severe problems next season.
Ollie, you've just said it there. Stoke is a more stable club. They are as sensible as you can possibly be. From all reports from Derby is that they have an owner or a chap called Mel Morris who wants to have a big say in team selection. He calls the managers back in when they lose and when they're on the way back home from games, and they have to go round his house and watch the video. I'm not sure it's a great job to be in the Derby job, even though he's doing well at the moment, Gary Rowett.
That has got to be a consideration, unless Mel Morris has sort of learned his lessons and become more hands off and realised that he's got a manager there who knows an awful lot more about football than he does. Then you could understand Rowett looking at it and thinking, well, you know, maybe this isn't the ideal club after all. But you know, they are second in the Championship. Stoke are in the relegation zone of the Premier League. It's not an easy one, but managers have got to kind of strike while the iron's hot sometimes. It's just a case, really, of whether his career would be better served by staying put, which it may be, than taking the obvious sort of jump up the ladder towards the bottom of the Premier League.
I wasn't quite sure whether we should talk about this next mini-debate topic, but I kind of feel that it's gone so far. I saw, you know, hey, our colleague Henry Winter yesterday on Sunday Supplement didn't really want to be talking about it. He says, can't we just get back to the football? And Conte and Mourinho in this spat, I don't want to go through who's right, who's wrong, because I can imagine you're both going to say something like they're both as bad as each other. And I'm not going to disagree with you. Until recently, we in Italy and in Spain we looked to England and said, oh, look, you know, this is so wonderful. When I remember at the Italian Job with Gianluca Vialli, and we spoke to Sir Alex and Mourinho and Lippi and Capello and Eriksen and so on.
Very good book, by the way. Thank you. Excellent book.
Some time back. You know, there was a sense that in Spain and in Italy and in France as well, we dwell on refereeing decisions for a long time. There's this poisonous atmosphere. People are constantly having jibes at each other, the managers. It's all very heavy and nasty. And that in England, you're all fabulous sportsmen. Now, this is mostly Luca's view, I think. And to be fair, you edit stuff like Pizzagate and Mind Games and Kevin Keegan's meltdown before that. But I do think that now the worm has kind of turned, because we don't have all this nastiness and controversy in certainly in Italy this season, or indeed in La Liga. But here in England, between these two, Conte Mourinho and Arsene Wenger, who, you know, last year gets a 4-match ban for shoving a referee, this year gets a 3-match ban for bursting into the guy's dressing room and threatening and abusing him. Ollie, this is nastier than it's been in a long, long time. Am I wrong here? Have the tables turned? Have you become like us?
Yeah, probably. But it's everything you were just saying then just reminded me of the whole thing that Sean Dyche was talking about in that interview with me a few weeks ago, where he said it's just becoming like a sport panto almost. Yeah, I don't know.
If you speak to him again, tell him that Gab Marcotti thinks that he's correct on that point.
Yeah, no,
it's different. It's different than what it was before.
He is newer, and you know, we in the media, obviously we in the media drum this up and hype it up, but then again, you look at Conte and Mourinho in these cases. Do Conte and Mourinho seem like people who have had to be dragged into this this battle and been coerced into saying things they didn't want to say? I think, you know, when Mourinho says, oh, well, I wasn't talking about him, I was talking about myself in my early days, I think Mourinho has since shown that before and since, that he's capable of delivering some pretty low blows, and Conte the same. It's as if they become just wrapped up in this idea that it's a soap opera, and they need to take personal digs at each other.
While they're doing that,
you know, Guardiola, who just doesn't get involved in that at all, to his credit, and Pochettino, who doesn't, and Klopp, who hasn't got involved too much, but you know, Guardiola's 15 points clearly must just be laughing at the pair of them, if indeed he takes any notice at all.
I don't understand why, because I really love Conte as a coach and a manager, why managers have to fall for Mourinho's tricks and why you have to answer them back. Mourinho wants that to happen. Why do managers fall for it?
I made the point before, last season, when Conte was on his best behaviour, not complaining about signings, referee, blah, 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 this was kind of new for Conte. He is somebody who's been spiky and who, if he gets it, you know, he's not going to be pushed around or intimidated. He didn't appreciate the lecture that Mourinho gave him last year when United lost at Stamford Bridge. And this is just kind of the way he is. And with Mourinho, you know, even the point when Mourinho's like, oh, I was talking about about myself and you in the media, you guys turned it around. I'm sorry. You're describing behavior that two other Premier League managers engage in, and you describe that and behavior that you used to engage in, and you describe that as clown behavior. That implies that you're saying people who do this are clowns. It's a little bit like me saying, like, oh, you know, I used to have a shaven head, but I look like an absolute freaking idiot. So now I don't look like an idiot anymore because my head's not shaved. And then Stuart gets angry at me. You probably don't shave your head.
I do.
Oh, you do? Okay. And I say, oh, well, Stuart, but I was talking about myself, right? No, because you've said that if you jump around on the sidelines, you're behaving like a clown, regardless if it was about you or whatever. So I kind of despair over this. And then the other guy who senile dementia, that's really offensive. Mm. That's really offensive. And people are like, oh, he meant amnesia. I'm sorry, but he was speaking in his own native language, in Italian. I would assume Conte may not have gone to have a fancy university education, but I'm assuming in his own language, he knows the difference between senile dementia and amnesia.
Well, the problem with football in general, and managers and coaches, There's very, very little information being given to the players out in the field. Managers seem to, their whole being on the side of the field is to wind up the opposition, to get at the fourth official, to get at the assistant referee, to have a go at the referee. And that's one of the things that is wrong with football.
I would agree with that. And the point is, I mean, I remember Rafa Benitez coming to Liverpool and he wanted absolutely no part of any of that business. No part of, you know, blaming referees, no part of getting involved in, with things with other managers.
And it just seems who like makes them do it in the end? Who makes this. Them do it in the end?
I think, you know, the whole Premier League product, the whole kind of pantomime, as Sean Dyche called it, of which we in the media are part, I think it just distorts the heads and they, you know, they get sucked into these sort of ego trips where if anybody has a go at them, they feel like they have to sort of fight fire with fire or fight fire with, I don't know, some kind of hand grenade or whatever. But it's Guardiola, as I said, has stayed out of it and has risen above it at times. And Pochettino seems impressively immune to it, although perhaps as, you know, as manager of nice little Tottenham, you know, he's not been subjected to too many of the barbs that others have been. But I just think other managers just get their egos get wrapped up in this pantomime, whether it impacts on their work and stops them doing anything they would otherwise do. I don't know, but it certainly doesn't do them any favours.
Well, I would say a lot of managers now are trying to manage through the press rather than managing their own players. And Mourinho is definitely the worst at it these days. When he came to Chelsea the first time, yes, he went through the press, but he was a brilliant coach that got Chelsea playing exactly how he wanted them to play. Now he's trying to manage the team through the press.
Ollie, you're going to give me some hope and... Because obviously it comes down to the manager's personality as well. I mean, you mentioned Benitez there. I remember, and you may remember this better than me, maybe like 10 years ago, Liverpool were playing Bolton, who were managed by Sam Allardyce at the time. And I think Xabi Alonso or somebody scored on a free kick and Benitez made some kind of gesture, like sort of like, that's it. And then both Allardyce and his mate, Sir Alex Ferguson, later when he came out and talked about how offensive it was, what Rafa Benitez did and so on. And it felt as if they were ganging up on him. And I have people tell me that part of the reason that we see this behavior today is that, you know, the sheriff has retired. In other words, when Sir Alex was here, sometimes he'd engage in some of this in his own way, in the mind games and whatever. But most of the time, he made sure people stayed in line, and Mourinho didn't dare ever mess with him. So you didn't have this sort of climate, and Wenger was younger and perhaps a little bit, you know, less wound up than he was today. Do you buy that?
You know, certainly a different feel among the managers, where, as I think somebody wrote in today's paper, was it Tony Cascarino, about how, you know, Fergie had you know, a number of people who were almost on Team Fergie as it was then, whether it was against Wenger or against Benitez or whoever. And those kind of alliances don't really exist anymore. I think in the case of Mourinho and Conte, it's while their teams are left flailing behind in the title race, it's almost like two ball men fighting over a comb. And that is not a relation, not a reference to anybody's... It's not a reference to thatch fixing.
There you go. All right, enough of this. How about some quick hits instead? Chelsea draw 0-0 at Norwich, which means Antonio Conte will be even grumpier with the prospect of a replay, but never mind that. Ollie, what do you make of the Barkley move? And why was the mayor of Liverpool, one Joe Anderson, I believe, so incensed?
Well, because he's an Everton fan, and he was angry that Everton have only got £15 million for one of the best products to come from their youth academy, and how it's you know, that's generally money that you pay for a Championship striker these days. And it's you know, Everton have lost out badly because you know, his contract had run down to the final months, and it's frustrating for them because, you know, they've not even seen him on the pitch this season. I think he is not a perfect player. He's got certain rough edges to his game. He can either sink or swim at Chelsea, but he is a player who will be a big loss to Everton. I think they've even missed him this season, despite all those various number 10s they've had. I think he would have done a better job than any of them this season.
AFC Wimbledon made things rather uncomfortable for Spurs for more than an hour before Harry Kane broke the deadlock and sent them on to a 3-0 win. Stuart, no reason to worry, is there? Not as long as the Hurricane is fit.
Harry Kane obviously is the star player for Spurs, but teams have come to Wembley, sat deep, frustrated Tottenham, and they haven't played with the same sort of pace and verve that they were playing with at White Hart Lane. I think the pitch is not cut quite so short, so the passing isn't quite as slick. They've just lost that little bit of pace in their attacks, but Spurs are still a very good side, so I can't see any problems for them.
There you go. Manchester City rolled to a 4-1 victory over Burnley. But what struck me, other than that fantastic Aguero goal, Ollie, was hearing a reserve left back, Alexander Zinchenko, saying that they think about doing the quadruple every day. And that's the sort of talk that Guardiola calls unrealistic in January. I want to ask you who's right, but also, like me, do you share my view that it's actually kind of neat that this kid, Zinchenko, and presumably other City players just pose absolutely no limits to what they can achieve, and they want to win everything.
I don't imagine it saying, "Yeah, we're going to win the quadruple," or it's quadruple or bust, or anything like that. It's about trying to win every game and win every competition, and that's healthy. I don't think when managers talk about trying to win the lot and it becomes a big thing in the media, you know, the treble bid, the quadruple bid, etc. I don't think that's healthy, but if they talk about it privately amongst themselves and trying to win everything, that's fair enough.
English football will have its first taste of video assistant refereeing tonight in the FA Cup as Brighton host Crystal Palace. Stuart, you've seen it work up close in MLS and Serie A and the Bundesliga and elsewhere. What's your take? Are your peeps ready for the VAR revolution?
I've done a lot of MLS games and they've got it absolutely right. They work very closely with the TV companies. We know exactly what's going on, and most of the right decisions are made. But it's still going to be open to debate. If we were talking about, was Lallana brought down by Holgate and it went to VAR, several different people will have a different view on that. So you're not going to get everything right, but I think it will work over a period of time.
I think the single biggest hurdle is people not understanding how it actually operates and works. Everybody's got these explainers out there. I think we have a particularly good one, although I may be biased here, in the game this Monday as well. And in that great example you cited with Lallana, what would happen is that the VAR would say to Bobby Madley, "Hey, Bobs, we think you might have made a clear error. Why don't you take a look at it?" And then he could take a look at it. He thinks, "Oh, look, I made a clear error." And then he overturns it. Or they would look at it and say, "We're not sure we got it right, but not enough for clear error," in which case it would be called what they call a silent check, and it wouldn't be overturned. I hope people understand this before they start moaning about, you know, what gets called, what doesn't called, and saying VAR is all rubbish.
It can only be called for certain situations.
Exactly.
There's only four things it can be called for.
Yeah, it strikes me as like if somebody comes stealing your house, so somebody goes and robs the artwork in Ollie Kay's conservatory, despite the CCTV system he has in place, it would be the equivalent of Ollie saying, "Oh, CCTV is rubbish," rather than saying, "Oh, look, how did this bad guy get into my house and rob the family silverware?"
It wouldn't be a very good idea to have artwork in the conservatory because it might fade from the sunlight. That's my view as somebody who doesn't collect art. But
I was referring to the sculpture garden you have at the end of your conservatory.
Different matter.
Ollie, I didn't mean to, but I sort of feel like I gave the FA Cup short shrift today. Fortunately, in the game this week, we have a pretty neat spread with 20 FA Cup tales that you may have missed, which I thought was actually one of the more entertaining reads this Monday. Do you want to give me something that stuck out for you that we haven't talked about on the show?
Well, the real sort of giant killings, you know, were perhaps overlooked in the case of Coventry beating Stoke, because probably a lot of people expected it, and probably because of the fallout at the Stoke end. But from Coventry's point of view, as a club that has gone through hell over the last decade, I think that was a really good win and a nice story. And Newport County beating Leeds, you know, coming from behind to beat Leeds, I think that was a great result and a great story too. And you know, looking at the, you know, various draws for clubs like Mansfield against Cardiff, for Shrewsbury against West Ham, and Wigan against Bournemouth, for Fleetwood against Leicester, you know, there are still the possibility of shocks in the replay. So I thought it was quite an interesting third round weekend.
There you go. Now, since our last show, Swansea have a new manager as well. Now, it's happened so long ago, we're not going to devote too much time to it, but Carlos Carvajal has replaced Paul Clement, or Paul Clement, as we called him when he was doing well. Robbo, what's your verdict?
I was always surprised that Paul Clement got the jobs he did at Derby and at Swansea. He did okay at the end of last season. I think he got the jobs on the back of your mate, the Italian manager that did so well all over the world. I think he was a decent coach, but never looked happy in the manager's job. So I think it was right that he was replaced. Whether Carvajal can do any better, we'll wait and see.
Am I right in thinking Carvajal did really well last season and then less well this year at Sheffield
that was
Wednesday?
The case. He did quite well for a couple of years at Sheffield Wednesday, I think, and got them into the playoffs, and then they didn't fulfil their potential in the playoffs. And this season, it didn't go well for him. He got the sack, and it wasn't long before he was back in a job at Swansea. And one for you, Gab. Diego Costa made his La Liga debut for Atletico Madrid. How did he get on?
He got on in a very, very Diego Costa manner, because he'd actually he'd made his club debut before in the Copa del Rey in midweek and scored, as you do. This time he started. He got a yellow card for a wayward elbow, and then he scored a really, really good goal. And then he decided that he was going to go and celebrate by jumping into the crowd, which is frowned upon because that got him a second yellow, and he was sent off. But I think, more realistically, I think this is a huge boost to Atletico Madrid. Obviously, the transfer ban in the summer, but between Diego Costa and Vitolo, who's also coming in, Spanish international, very direct player, I think they've really kicked it up another notch. And I'll tell you what, if they were still in the Champions League,
which they're not,
which they're obviously not, I would have had them as dark horses at this stage. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Ollie Kay, and in the studio, Stuart Robson. Now, you're probably used to me saying that it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Well, we've gone even better. We have a special winter offer, of course, named for our chief football writer, Henry Winter. It's just £3 for a 3-month trial. I make that £3 for 3 months is what? 12 weeks? 13 weeks if you're very lucky? To me, that's a tremendous offer. So give it a go. Just search The Times online and you get access to all our content. Not just our content, but the Sunday Times as well. How about a bit of Johnny Northcroft for you and maybe some Duncan Castles on the side? We're going to be back on Monday as we turn our attention back to the Premier League with what could be a goal fest at Anfield. It's Liverpool versus Manchester City.
The game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.